Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Teutonic Zionism. It is not Semitic Jewish Zionism, no. The word is Teutonic, T-E-U-T-O-N-I-C.
The Teutonic Knights are the German branch of the Knights Templars.
That's right. That's the name of the tune, the Teutonic Zionism. It's a whole secret order that has been in operation for 1,000 years. It is the whole story behind America, England, and the things which are going on the earth today. And if you don't understand Hanseatic League and Teutonic Zionism, you're never going to figure out the name of the tune and how this thing is being played. And I've been looking at this for 48 years, and I'm telling you that unless and until you have the whole story, you're not going to get to the bottom of anything. Because like I said in the beginning, the first hour, your decisions in life are only as good as your information, and the really extraordinary information has never been allowed to be given to the people. So I'm just getting you started into a truly arcane occult research.
Well, on the Teutonic Knights that really grew into the Templars and vice versa.
That's
so
right.
After they knocked out the Templars, there were still the Teutonic Knights. I only know about the Teutonic Knights because I read Mein Kampf, I read other books about the Nazis, and Hitler thought that he was creating the recreated Teutonic Knights. We know the British follow that.
That's right.
And again, this goes back to them believing they're the seed of Jesus, they're the God race.
Now you're getting it. That's exactly right.
And so that's why people can't get why the political Zionists who were supposedly Jewish were funding Hitler, why Hitler allowed Jews to leave to Israel but nowhere else. Why at the highest levels you'll have Zionists right next to top Nazis at Bilderberg, and it's right. I've said when you kick in that final door, it's a room full of Nazis and Kabbalists.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm saying, and that's why I'm saying you better go back. And
that's what Steven Spielberg is telling us in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
He's trying to tell you something. Twice, the Nazis, three times, the last one. The Nazis are in it, and the first two times, the Nazis are looking for the lost Ark of the Covenant. Why would the Nazis care a damn about a Jewish symbol of the covenant, or the covenant of the lost Ark of the Covenant? Why would Nazis care about the lost Ark of the Covenant, a Jewish symbol? Why would they care about the Christian symbol of the Holy Grail? The second one, the Last Crusade. Why is he putting so much emphasis on the Knights Templars, the Masonic Knights Orders of the Teutonic Knights? They're trying to tell you something.
Okay, going back to Jordan Maxwell, he was talking about the Teutonic Zionist, and again separately from Jordan Maxwell, because I've been a big reader. I can confirm what he's saying because I happen to read Heinz Hobel, Order of the Death's Head, Scheer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, two of Hitler's books, Mein Kampf, and then The New World Order. I happen to know that they believe in the Teutonic Knights. This predates the Templars. Mainstream history teaches you the Templars became the Teutonics, but really, they were the tree from which the Templars rose. Then when that tree was cut down and ran to Northern England or to Scotland, the real heart of it grew back up. Am I correct in saying that, Jordan?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, because the Teutonic thing goes way back into ancient history, way back. Yeah, that's a whole study in itself. That's why I said, put the two together, the Teutonic Zionism, which is Semitic Zionism, it's Teutonic Zionism, and Hanseatic League. And again, the word is H-A-N-S-E-A-T-I-C. Hanseatic League and Teutonic Zionism will begin to open up a can of worms that you're not going to believe.
Well, tell us about the Hanseatic League.
Well, it's a league of German bankers and thinkers, philosophers, but especially bankers and commercial enterprises in Germany under the Second Reich, which was under Kaiser Wilhelm, and even way before that, before the German nation came to be a nation. So it's a whole confederation of bankers, thinkers, philosophers who were basically...
They created
together.
The modern education system.
That's
they
right.
created the PhD.
That's it.
They engineered the whole society. They created NASA. They created our CIA. They
now
merged with the British-German aristocracy. And again, I'm not absolving the modern corrupt murderous Zionists. The point is, I have found that they are actually their plaything, and that they
of
have
course.
Intermarried in with the Rothschilds. And every time I knock down that final door, this is a Germanic death cult that believes they are the true Zionist.
That's it. That's the name of the tune, and you said it all. That's it. So let's move on.
But I mean, all I try to do, though, is report what I really find in history. But then the Catholic system... is trying to set up the new Rome and is hooked in with the Teutonics, is it not?
Oh, of course it is. Of course it is.
But then I say it's only part of it. I mean, I'm saying Zionists, Catholics, all of it, the Protestants. But see, no, they want to keep us compartmentalized, divided and conquered, don't they?
You're right.
A dynasty turns jet. Things were getting back to normal in 1945, but what, in family terms, was normalcy? The house at Hamilton Place, built by Leo, became one of London's most luxurious clubs. Another Rothschild residence in Kensington Gardens now constitutes the Soviet Russian Embassy. And in France, the Titanic manse at 2 Rue Florentin on the Place de la Concorde has gone the way of all Titanic manses. Talleyrand had lived there before Edouard de Rothschild moved in. When Edouard put it on the market, only one customer could afford the price, Uncle Sam. It became the European headquarters of the Marshall Plan, and today is tenanted by the United States Mission to NATO and to European regional organizations. Henri de Rothschild's huge place at 33 Rue de Faubourg Saint-Honoré now houses the Cercle Interallier, a fancy international diplomatic club. On the same street, the United States Embassy has taken over number 41, built by the first Baron Edmond. The Rothschild monograms still crown the great portals of both houses. Last, not least, Ferrières, the crown jewel among Rothschild possessions. No one was rich enough to buy it, nor did the French branch want to part with such a symbol.
Initially, a great deal of labor went into untangling the various pre-war debts on which countries like Chile and Hungary had defaulted. New issues, like the 1951 offering of £5 million of stock for the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, usually known as the World Bank, had to be shared with other city houses. The old Rothschild predominance in the South African gold market had already been reasserted 3 years previously, when the international gold market reopened. Once again, the world gold price was formally set in Newcourt's fixing room.
Through a string of holding companies, Newcourt could now tap monumental lumber, power, mineral, particularly uranium, resources. And Winston Churchill, appreciative of the scale of the thing, termed it a grand imperial concept. After Antony's death, his two nephews, Edmund and Leopold, took over together with Antony's son, Evelyn.
In addition, Evelyn sat on the boards of Beaverbrook Newspapers, The Economist, and later The Telegraph PLC.
Edmund, the senior partner, struck out in still other directions, as owner and operator of the Royal Mint Refinery, as gold agent to the Bank of England, and as merchant banker extraordinary, consolidating still further Newcourt's position as a key bullion broker in the English Commonwealth.
And laying the foundation for its present preeminent position in the Australian natural resources market. Rothschild Australia accounts for around a third of the N.M. Rothschild Group's profits. It retained its long-standing interest in gold, even after the breakdown of the gold pool as a consequence of the pressures brought to bear on the dollar by the Vietnam War. Above all, it was to the countries of the developing European economic community that the bank looked. Most far-sighted of all was the Rothschild plan for a new currency called the Euro, European Composite Unit, based on the values of 9 major European currencies, forerunner of the later EQ and Euro. In September 1967, a channel study group was formed, along with Morgan Grenfell, Lazar, and Barings, in an effort to revive the old Victorian dream of a tunnel under the English Channel. N.M. Rothschild maintained its interest in the project and acted as advisor to the European Channel Tunnel Group, which initiated the present channel in 1981. It was at around this time that Guy, the head of the Paris House, was being touted in some quarters as EEC Banker Rothschild.
The French Rothschilds are richer still, and they have become richer faster since Baron Guy assumed the reins at the death of his father, Edouard. With similar aggressiveness, Guy has fortified the position of de Rothschild Frères as the largest private bank in France. His main instrument here is the Compagnie du Nord, the railroad network, which became family property after the dynast James financed it into existence. Through its railroad-turned-investment trust, the family controlled, and after the Nazi nightmare, controls again, mining corporations, metal plants, oil interests, chemical industries, and many others. This sort of setup requires a feudal allegiance. There are whole families that have been on the Rothschild payroll for over a century.
A first tentative step in this direction was taken in 1960, when N.M. Rothschild and Warburgs placed £340,000 shares in the August Thyssen Steel Company on the London market, the first German shares to be quoted in London since the war.
Then there is Guy's cousin, Edmond. He is faithful enough to family discretion to keep the portals of number 45, Rue de Faubourg Saint-Honoré, signless and anonymous. From this headquarters, he runs the Compagnie Financière, a worldwide organization which builds villas, hotels, pipelines in Israel, throws up giant housing projects in Paris, finances banks and car factories in Brazil. He greatly enlarged the family holdings on the slopes of Mont Blanc, complete with ski lifts, swimming pools, tennis courts, and nightclubs. He also underwrites and develops not merely hotels, but entire new tourist regions in Martinique and Guadeloupe in the French Caribbean. With Lord Rothschild as partner, he is responsible for the flowering of Israel's luxury golf resort at Caesarea. Edmond James Rothschild Memorial Group contributed $1 million to the Weizmann Scientific Institute in Tel Aviv, gave $3 million towards the construction of the Knesset, and foots the bill for many of Israel's archaeological expeditions.
Pre-1914 links to Japan were also renewed by Edmond, who made several visits there between 1962 and 1969, arranging euro-dollar bond issues in partnership with Nomura Securities for a number of Japanese companies, including Hitachi and Pioneer. The logical way of advancing Britain's financial integration with the continent was to establish some kind of cross-channel institutional link. The creation of Rothschild's Continuation Holdings AG as the Swiss-based parent company was in this sense pregnant with historical significance. To recreate something like the system of international partnership which had been the Rothschild's greatest strength in the 19th century. The N.M. Rothschild Group is thus a multinational entity. More than 50% of its assets are now held outside the UK, with a wide geographical reach. Again, reminiscent of the system of houses which had been developed by Meyer Amschel's sons after 1815.
Mushrooms of the genus Amanita possess hallucinogenic effects and have been used by Siberian shamans as a psychotropic drug for centuries. However, these mushrooms are rare, and often only the richest in the village can afford them, but the hallucinogenic agent passes unchanged through the urine. So the common villagers traditionally have collected the rich man's piss and ingested it in order to get themselves high. America is now in a similar position. The top 1% own the same amount of wealth as the bottom 90%, and we're left standing below their penthouses getting pissed on and thanking them for the privilege. Thank you, Mr. Billionaire. It's an honor to take your trickle-down economics in my face. So if you're in this situation, there's three ways you can respond. One, you can refuse the urine, but in our case, the trickle is filled with money, so it can't easily be refused. Two, drink it angrily while finding ways to fight back, ways to interrupt the mushroom supply chain and make it a more fair system. Or three, drink the trickle happily and convince yourself that this is the way it should be, and you love getting pissed on. If anyone stands up and says there's a better way, there's a more fair way, there's a way that involves less urine in our eyes, then you shout them down and call them unpatriotic and perhaps a fag for good measure. Just keep taking it with a smile on your face and thank the power elite for being so generous as to piss in your general direction. Right now, most of us are choosing that third option. Thank you, billionaires. As our economy struggles to recover after being pillaged by you and your associates, most of us fight to make ends meet. And you're actually richer than you were before the collapse. But every once in a while, your piss splatters a couple of nickels our way. And therefore, we're going to keep voting for you and your friends. We'll keep using your banks and stores, your media outlets, and your whorehouses. Just make sure to piss a little on my shoes, okay? Just promise us that you'll give us 20 cents off that blue stuff that goes in the toilet and 40 cents off that piece of plastic that makes my cell phone look snazzy. And not only will we keep propping you up, we'll even do your dirty work for you. We'll attack people who criticize you for pissing on us. We'll tear gas our own fucking teenagers who try to fight back against the madness. We'll listen to your propaganda and verbally attack teachers and cops for having the fucking temerity to have health care. We'll even act friendly to the banker who tells us our home has been foreclosed on because we're trying to maintain a sense of decency that you all abandoned long ago. Just please don't avert your trickle. I'm Lee Camp, and that's your moment of clarity. Get more of these at leecamp.net.
There is a peaceful solution called the Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it, so let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it, and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy day to tune in and grow in the light direction. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service, and it's without corporate sponsorship, and it's published commercial free and free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click on the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein over 1,000 thinkers from all around the world are engaging in a fear-free zone of mutual respect while individually sharpening our intellectual self-defense skills and practicing the universal arts of liberation. If, after listening to today's episode, you'd like to know more, Peace Revolution has several partner podcasts, including Media Monarchy, Corbett Report, Gnostic Media, and Remedy Radio, all listed in the episode notes, and all of which lead by example and are likewise commercial-free and funded by those who find their media to be of value in today's world. Speaking of valuable media, I've just published a new 2-hour video interview with Professor Chengia Raghavan, who attended the University of Oxford, the University of Cambridge, the University of London, and the University of Sussex, among other fine establishments. All of this after he was a political prisoner in South Africa and later exiled from South Africa by its government. So I can promise that during the 2 hours, he'll constantly ping your mind with ideas which may seem provocative But in listening to the words spoken by someone who grew up as a slave during apartheid, working on a sugar plantation, you'll find his words inspiring as well as enlightening. We filmed this interview just a few hours before filming the weekend interview with John Taylor Gatto. Thanks to Paul Verge for posting this interview on the YouTube, as I don't have time to cut it into 15-minute parts, and Paul's privileges allow him to post it in HD and in its entirety. Thanks also to Jitu Huntley for helping me perform the interview, as I had many, many last-minute tasks to complete before that weekend's production with Gatto. If you'd like to help us continue getting the word out, in addition to sharing this podcast with your friends, you can support our latest media projects, including our new series, Navigating Netflix, which is in its post-production on second episode, What You've Been Missing, which is in pre-production on its second episode, and the multi-DVD series entitled A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, The Ultimate History Lesson. With over 5 hours of John discussing his life's work in high definition and studio quality sound, those who donate $50 or more to this project will receive the DVD set, which will be finished in a few weeks. And if you're listening to this in real time, that applies to you. And if you're listening in the not-so-near future, you'll be able to find this DVD set at johntaylorgatto.com as well as tragedyandhope.com. And to donate, you can use any of the donate buttons on the side of any of our websites, including peacerevolution.org, as well as the notes for this episode therein. And now, for today's main event. This episode, in particular, if you haven't already, you might want to get yourself a notebook and sit down at a table and take some notes, and get familiar with all the links I've included in the references at peacerevolution.org. Because this is one class they will definitely not sell you, not in college, not in a corporation, and not likely anywhere else on this planet at this time. And it comes with a listing of impeccable references and points of further exploration, and this is the first episode in which the notes and references include links to the brain model, which I've created over the past several years. And what that means to you is that likely, for the first time, you'll be able to see how all of these topics interconnect visually, with all the contextual information you'll need to actually and factually understand these matters. But moreover, this is a tool which you can use to communicate with others, through which all parties will sharpen their understanding and communication abilities and adjust their perspectives thusly, dismissing the arbitrary and focusing on what actually exists in reality. This is where real progress, which is not in conflict with human needs for survival, originates. This exemplifies the learning process, without which we as human beings will continue to take actions which are in direct conflict with our needs for survival. And that just seems irrational. Recognizing that, we have the ability to choose to be rational. To that end, if you've been studying the Trivium method of critical thinking and creative problem solving, you'll note that the three steps, which are grammar, logic, and rhetoric, also known as knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, are embedded throughout the brain model which I've created, the title of which, A Comprehensive Ontology of Cognitive Liberty, identifies the individual components of knowledge pertinent to understanding the world, providing you with the definitions and encyclopedic references for each point. There are approximately 4,000 topics in this brain model, and these individual pieces of knowledge, or general grammar of our world and our place in it, are connected to the other existence with which they share relative connectivity. This is the logic step, where we gain a comprehensive understanding. The act of you going into the notes, clicking through the links, and cruising around the model, driving yourself through your own mind-expanding journey of learning, is what this life is all about. It is the rhetoric of this model, whereby I transition useful knowledge into your understanding through communication provided by the metaphor, which is the model. In this case, the model is the metaphor. What we're offering to you is access to a contextual understanding that begins with my model and inspires you to download the software, it's free, and start creating your own models.
You could start by modeling all that you learn from your notes during the exploration of this 35th episode. And if you're a new listener, you'll derive the most value from this virtual classroom if you start at episode 1. And taking notes and exploring the references provided, learn your way forward with a genuine understanding which cannot be offered in any traditional classroom. This episode is a prime example of what mature grown-ups need to be aware of, understand, and avoid in their own lives. I'll be featuring a 1934 Hollywood film which was nominated for an Academy Award and was produced as a public relations metaphor for the Rothschild family, and it's aptly entitled The House of Rothschild. Therein you'll find a plethora of history not taught to us in schools, and yet there it is, right in front of our eyes and ears. The full-length video version of this film is found on YouTube and also linked in the episode notes. I'll also be calling upon a montage of history crafted from Niall Ferguson's two-volume history of the Rothschild Empire, and I'll mention for all of our sakes that the music underneath this part of the episode is part of the source material and not of my doing. And I'll note that if you tune out the noise and tune into the signal of that message, you'll have plenty of information from which to model your reality using the brain software. From Moses Hess in his 1862 book describing the future creation of a Zionist state in Palestine, using the Illuminati agenda of infiltrating Freemasonic lodges with the money of Cecil Rhodes and the Rothschild family, to the fact that Rhodes' last will and testament leaves his money back to the Rothschild family, whose interests are then in control of the Rhodes Scholars, the CFR Roundtable Group, the De Beers Cartel, not to mention the London School of Economics, Reuters, The Economist, and Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call, which are used by our Senate and Congress. These are the publications shaping our world today. And this episode provides you with everything from how to understand World War I and the Balfour Declaration, which went into effect on September 11th, 1922, to create the future Zionist state in Palestine, all the way up through 9/11 and today's economic calamities, cascading their consequences far into the future. I could say more, but if you're really interested, it's all in the episode notes. Click, read, learn, repeat. That is how you get to where you want to be. Use your five senses and the brain. Use the trivium and find serenity by modeling an understanding of the world around you. This is episode 35, The House of Rothschild, The World's Banker. Thank you for your support and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Locking up time. The money hasn't come yet.
It's a long road from Hamburg. It'll be here in the morning.
Yes, but if anything should happen, all that money, 10,000 gulden.
Eh? So much this journey?
7,000 in one lump from Prince Lowenstein's agent, and then all the small sums, 10,000 at least.
The roads are dangerous. Tomorrow morning it'll be here. We should be thankful, Maya. Business is good, eh?
Nearly 1,000 gulden since morning. Mama.
Eh?
That agent. Did you notice him?
What?
There he sat, sly and smiling, planning to rob this poor old Jew Rothschild. And here I was, so innocent. A little child. A baby, in fact. And there was that fine old clock that his master had sent him to bargain for.
Yes.
And when at last I let him have it for less money than it cost me, I could see in his eyes how pleased he was that he got the better of this little baby.
So what it undercost?
A sprat to catch a mackerel, Mama. He thinks he's so clever, and I'm so stupid. Always make them think they're clever. Mama!
Eh?
I've been robbed.
Meyer!
Bad! A whole garden. A dead loss. Bad.
Are you sure? Sometimes they're only cracked. Right, Meyer. Who gave it you? Could it be that?
That agent. And I gave him some wine, too. Some of the good wine.
Meyer. You come again.
Yeah. You come again. And then, Mama, I catch my mackerel.
Well, no one can ever say you don't deal fairly with your customers, Mama.
It pays in the end, Mama.
Now finish your account, and I'll lay the supper.
All right, Mama. It shan't be very long now.
The roast is almost done.
It smells good.
Pat.
Looks good, too.
Mama, quick! Make him!
Mama, the tax collector.
Oh. Papa, the tax collector. He's down the street.
Shut door. The tax collector, boys. Mama, put away the silver.
I have. Don't forget my big account book.
Oh, run away. What do you know about it?
Everything is in the tax collector now.
Take those hats off.
Hey, Mama.
Yes.
Hurry up, Carl. Come up, James. Over the fireplace. Remember, no deal for the last 5 days. Understand?
Yes, Father.
Are you hungry?
Not so very.
Then look hungry.
Look hungry.
Anselm Solomon, you remain below. Mama, hide the roast. Your sewing is there. Nathan, by me.
Nathan, take your hands out of your pocket.
Open up, Joe.
Who is it, Nathan?
Alan Rothschild.
Why, it's my good friend, the tax collector.
Bring out your account book.
Certainly, sir. Here it is. I was just looking over it. Things are very bad. I was saying to my poor wife, Gudula, this is our friend, the tax collector. Never have I known such a bad month.
No.
For 5 days, not one garden have I seen. Customers come, yes, but they don't buy.
No.
Then no one's traveling these days, so my exchange business is worse than nothing. I shall soon starve.
Starve, eh? Come on. Something smells good.
Hmm. One of our neighbors must be having a roast. Close the window, Mama.
What do you take me for? Now bring out the real books.
Real books? Why, Excellency, I don't understand what you mean.
Rothschild, you're doing more business than any Jew in Jew Street. You're going to pay 20,000 golden.
20,000?
Oh.
Why, a council of the big merchants in the city doesn't pay as much as that.
That's another matter. He's outside the ghetto. Oh. He's not a Jew.
Oh, if you were going to kill me this instant, I could barely raise 1,000 gulden.
Upstairs. That's the house. Pull the badger palm.
Well, I might perhaps raise 2,000 gulden.
Very interesting.
Oh, that. Nathan, lift up the trap door for the gentleman. Just some old stock. We have a little wine down there. Not very good wine, I'm afraid. Good wine costs money.
But no account books, no gold, no jewels, I suppose.
Jewels. Jewels. I've had to give up dealing in jewels long ago. It needs capital. Shall I lead the way?
You follow. At a distance. Stand up, Jew boys. Wine. Fill up a cup.
But that's green, Excellency.
Do as I say. Oh, it had wine in it after all, eh? Slop.
Yes, sir, that's what we drink.
Ah.
But there's some here that Bala keeps for his facial customers. Won't your Excellency try it?
You old fox. It's good.
Your Excellency does us honor.
Rothschild, apparently you've been telling me the truth. So do you know what I'm going to do?
No, Excellency.
I'm going to charge you 20,000 gulden just the same.
But I can't do it. There's not that much money in the whole ghetto.
Rothschild. You'd like to pay only 2,000 gulden again, wouldn't you?
Yes, Excellency.
Now, what would it be worth to me if I put you down for 2,000 this time?
A very handsome present for your Excellency. Say, 1,000 gulden.
Talk sense, Rothschild. I want 10,000.
Would you leave me and my family penniless?
With a great deal of pleasure. Come now.
Well, perhaps 3,000 gulden, but that's the limit. The actual limit.
I'll take 6,000.
Well, I will. We'll make it 5,000.
All right. Have it ready tomorrow. I'll call. And if any of you breathe a word, I'll have your house burned to the ground.
Boys, you did well. Nathan, you're a smart lad. That wine,
Mama,
you should have seen him. And after all, a 5,000 gulden isn't as bad as it might have been.
No.
But it is bad to have to pay away 5,000 gulden.
Not as bad as having to pay away 20,000, Father.
6 o'clock, all Jews inside.
Can't wait all night.
Come on,
let's get out of this ghetto. What?
Shall I go after him?
Oh, let him go.
Mr. Rothschild. Mr. Rothschild. What's the matter? What's happened? The man who was bringing your money from Hamburg has been waylaid by the tax agents outside the city.
What?
They heard he was bringing the money to Jew Street. They might have killed him, but he got away.
He got away with the money?
No, they got it, Mr. Rothschild. They got the money.
What? All of it?
Yes, all of it.
You hear that, Mama? You hear that, all of you? 10,000 golden. Our money that we worked for. Why doesn't your magic strike them dead?
Papa, don't get excited. It's bad for you.
Now listen. You are young. Your lives are before you. You've got to fight. Fight for yourselves. Fight for our people.
Mama, I have to cheat the tax collector before my own children. Do you think I want to do that? I live honestly. I trade honestly. I want to be honest with them. But they won't let us. We are Jews. Taxed to death. Forbidden to learn a trade. Forbidden to own land. They keep us in chains. They send men here to rob us. So work and strive for money. Money is power. Money is the only weapon that the Jew has to defend himself with. Oh, Mama!
Come,
speak with you, all of you. We're here, Papa, all of us.
My sons, when I go, I leave you in your mama's care. She is wise, far wiser than I, and good. Do always as she says, and you will grow rich. Come closer. Much money is lost through sending gold by coach from one country to another. In times of war, it is seized by the enemy. In times of peace, by thieves. You are five brothers. I want you each to start a banking business in a different country. One to go and open a house in Paris, one in Vienna, one in London. Choose the most important centers. So that when money is to be sent from here to London, let us say, you won't have to risk life and gold. Hampshire, here in Frankfurt, will just send a letter to Nathan in London saying, pay so-and-so. And that will be offset by loans from London to Frankfurt. Understand?
Yes.
In your day, there will be many wars in Europe. And nations that have money to transport will come to the Rothschilds because it will be safe.
Papa, you mustn't talk anymore. The doctor...
I'm giving advice to our sons, Mama, that the doctor cannot give. Remember, unity is strength. All your lives you must stand by one another. No one brother must be allowed to fail while another brother succeeds. Your five banking houses may cover Europe, but you will be one firm, one family, the Rothschilds, who work always together. That will be your power. And when that power comes, remember the ghetto.
I shall be here. I shall never leave the house where they were all born.
And remember this before all, that neither business, nor power, nor all the gold in Europe will bring you happiness till we, our people, have equality, respect, dignity, to trade with dignity, to live with dignity. Walk the world with dignity.
If Napoleon is to be beaten in the East, we must have 15 million florins immediately, and more later.
I think it can be done, Prince Metternich, but I shall have to consult with my brother Nathan in London.
Come, come, Solomon, can't you decide now?
Your Highness is aware that the Rothschilds work as a family, and we've made Nathan our head.
Rothschild, there can be no peace in Europe as long as Napoleon controls Italy. 16 million ducats, as soon as possible.
If your Highness will keep the utmost secrecy, I will endeavor to obtain the consent of my brothers.
You must realize, Monsieur de Talleyrand, how difficult it is for the Paris House of Rothschild to help the Allies against Napoleon.
My dear Monsieur James, I will be as secret as the grave. But we must have 50 million francs.
Your visit honors our house, Count Ledras.
Quite aware of that answer, Rothschild. I wish no one to hear it. Only necessity brings me here. The armies of Napoleon are already in Prussia. We've got to have 5 million gulden. Drive them out.
I will consult my brother.
Ah, that's nonsense.
It is an unbreakable rule, Your Excellency. The House of Rothschild never participates in a deal of this importance without the approval of all the partners. That is impossible. My brother Nathan in London is permitted to make a decision.
Mr. Nathan, it may be that just one more loan will carry us to victory. You've been most generous, you and your brothers too. And I can assure you, sir, that His Majesty fully realizes that the House of Rothschild has already contributed 10 times as much as any other banking house in Europe. Captain Fitzroy arrived this morning from Wellington's headquarters, and he's told me how much the General appreciates what you've done.
Lord Wellington's language on the battlefield can't be repeated, sir. But I've heard him declare that he wouldn't swap any one of those 5 Rothschilds for any 5 of Napoleon's Brigade.
May I tell the Prime Minister you agree to one more loan?
Do you realize, gentlemen, that the Allies are drawing on us throughout Europe?
It's money that wins wars.
It's money that makes war.
With £5 million, we can hold Napoleon at bay.
Mr. Harris, tell the Prime Minister I decline to raise £5 million to keep the Allies fighting Napoleon.
I'm sorry.
But you can tell Lord Wellington that the 5 Rothschilds will let him have £10 million if he'll guarantee to smash Napoleon. Oh, excuse my hat, gentlemen.
Once more, England is indebted to her greatest soldier. It is my privilege as Prime Minister to thank him on behalf of England for his glorious achievement.
We rejoice at your safe return.
My lords and gentlemen, charge your glasses. I give you a toast. His Grace, the Duke of Wellington.
Well, that's over.
Ah, empty.
Who's got some snuff here?
Yeah.
England's the greatest soldier.
Yeah, that's all right.
May I shake your hand, Your Grace?
Thank you. Yeah, here it is.
Why wasn't Rothschild here?
There was some feeling.
Wasn't he asked?
Well, no, Your Grace. Some of these people...
Wasn't the man who paid for these dash wars important enough?
It wasn't a question of importance, it
well,
was...
Well, if he can't come here, I suppose we can still go there. Hey, Fitz.
Yes, sir.
Just as soon as I can get away, we're going to call on Nathan Rothschild. He ought to have been here. Dash light, I call it. Ah, more snuff. Do you know where the old boy lives?
Very well indeed, sir.
Oh, you young blackguard. I'd forgotten about that daughter of his.
Darling.
No, I'm not sorry. Not in the least.
Neither am I. Just up.
I've been trying to tell you for a long time. I've wanted to kiss you.
Yes, I know that. But when it came, it was so sudden, it rather frightened me.
Frightened? The captain of the guards to protect you? Ridiculous.
Well, the captain of the guards is a very dangerous person.
Only to his rivals.
You know, you're a very conceited young man.
Hmm?
You haven't even asked me if I loved you.
Well, don't you?
Yes, I do. I love you more than anything else in the world.
And then tonight, after I tucked the Duke into bed, I'll call on your father. My speech to him is all ready. I've rehearsed it not less than 1,000 times. The trees at night, the guns, even the horses. I haven't gotten a refusal yet.
I'm afraid it's not as simple as that.
Some of those horses were pretty difficult customers.
It's no use, darling. You're just dodging the real reason. You're being sweet and thoughtful again. But you're not making me forget that you're a Gentile and I'm a Jewess. Think of the shock to our families.
This is no longer a family matter. Spitz and Julie.
Hush, hush, hush.
I've had that crowd at me heels all day. If they had any sense, it's you they'd be following around, not me.
Oh, we Rothschilds have had just as big crowds following at our heels in Frankfurt, but not with cheers.
Well, I'll cheer for you, gladly. And I hope one day Europe will realize she owes you something more than money.
Well, my father was a man of peace. He told us never to loan money to make wars, always to end them. And that's been our principle.
Well, everybody knows that and respects you for it.
No, Your Grace, they don't know it. And they don't respect us. Arab bankers are jealous of us. The man in the street thinks we're just Shylocks. And Europe hides its head for shame because it borrows from the Jews.
I suppose you know it's that Prussian fellow, Count Lederanz, that's responsible for that rot.
I know. He hates me and all my race.
He's a proper jackass, Rothschild. And he ought to be hanged.
I must admit that the same happy thought has occurred to me more than once.
You know, it's a danger having a man like that in authority. Always making enemies.
Well, yes, that's a danger. They may need us again.
What do you mean?
Well, perhaps we're not out of the woods yet.
Why, Napoleon's scotched.
Napoleon's in exile, but he's not dead.
As good as dead, Rothschild. As good as dead.
Ah, perhaps. Another brandy, Your Grace.
Ah.
I often thought it would have saved a lot of trouble if Napoleon had been born an Englishman.
Oh. Where would I be then?
Why, his commanding officer, of course.
Oh, thank you. Sound brandy you've got here, Rothschild.
To the peace of Europe.
Well, I'm a soldier, but I'll drink to that. I see, Rothschild. A little secret. Mind you, I oughtn't to tell you this, but I just heard this morning that they are going to float a dash big loan to put France on her feet. An enormous loan. The biggest thing ever issued.
Yes?
Well, they've got to do something. France has had 20 years of war and the whole country's torn up. But now they've got peace. They're going to get together, the five allied powers, and help her out.
And the banking house that floats this loan will at once become the most powerful in Europe. Its prestige will be enormous.
That's it. Now's your chance.
Your Grace, I can't sufficiently thank you for this information.
Mind you, it's a dash dark secret. But it serves the chuckleheads right for telling me. They ought to know by now I can't keep a secret.
Send a message to Mr. Roth and ask him to come to me here at once.
Yes, sir.
We'll drink to the house that floats the new French loan.
To the house of Rothschild. And its greatest member. Huh. Ah, there you are. Miss Julie.
Your Grace.
Mrs. Rothschild, you've got to watch this young rooster. I'm beginning to understand now why you were always asking for leave to return to London.
Now that you do understand, I trust you'll let him come more often.
It's against the regulation.
Oh.
I only saw Julie 5 times, sir.
And once when you sent him the dispatches to the Prime Minister, Julie was waiting for him at the corner of Downing Street.
That, I hope, isn't against the regulations, Your Grace.
Not if he didn't speak to you.
We didn't think you knew about that, Nathan.
Ah. I'm afraid it's time to go, Your Grace.
All right. You can't fox this man. He's a magician. There's no question about that. Oh, I see, Rothschild. I've been told you knew about Napoleon's abdication 2 days before the War Office did. Is that true?
Yes, but then the War Office never knows anything for 2 days after everybody else knows it.
Yes, and then they take 2 more days thinking it over. But how did you do it? They say Indians get things by putting their ears to the ground, but you are not an Indian, are you?
No, just plain Jerusalem with a heart of gold.
Well, I know something about sending dispatches. My man Fitzroy here is the best at that. But if I had 20 Fitzes, I couldn't do it in that time. You knew about Napoleon's abdication almost as soon as it happened. How the deuce did you do it?
A little bird whispered in my ear.
Oh, you don't intend to tell me, eh? Well, I don't blame you. Fitz, we'd better go before he makes us disappear like rabbits in a hat. Mrs. Rothschild, you've a charming home. And a charming daughter.
Your Grace.
Hope that dash crowd's gone. Ah, thank you. Are they still there?
Oh. And this is the man who faced the Grand Army.
Hush, hush, hush. Here, Fitzroy.
Yes, sir. Brandy before the charge, always.
Ah, there's military tactics for you. There's a young man who'll be a general someday.
Thank you. Oh, goodbye, Rothschild. And remember, it's a dash dark secret.
A thousand thanks, Your Grace. There he goes, longing for the peace and the quiet of the battlefield. Yes, sir.
Mom. Mom, I ought to be very happy, but I'm not quite.
What is it, dear?
Fitz says it's nobody's business but ours. Just his and mine. But it's his wretched family I'm thinking of. You know, Mother, nearly all of his aunts are duchesses and countesses, and oh, I'm so afraid they'll turn up their noses.
He doesn't object to our money, I hope.
No. He says he's willing to overlook that.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Father, please don't think of Fitz like that.
Please don't. You're hurting her, Nathan. Isn't that rather cruel?
Oh, no, it's my fault. I never told Father I really cared as much as I do.
And you didn't either of you think I knew. We businessmen are not supposed to notice unimportant things like daughters and wives. You should know better than that, Hannah.
Well, I knew she loved him, but we thought we'd tell you when you got to know him better.
Julie, you know the tradition of our family, a Rothschild to marry a Rothschild.
But I wasn't a Rothschild, Nathan.
No, but you were Hannah, and you were one of our race.
That's what frightens me, Mom, these dreadful prejudices. Could we bear it? Fitz bear it.
I won't pretend, Julie, that I wouldn't rather you married one of your own people.
It's a cruel barrier.
Yes. But the world's changed a bit, especially in England. There's no Jew Street here. And they're lifting other chains from us, too. So, perhaps...
Oh, no. No, don't say perhaps. Say yes.
What do you think, Hannah?
I think girls should be allowed to make their own choice.
Ah, I'm not sure that I agree with you.
Oh, but this girl, Father...
Well, it's about the first time that I've known a Rothschild to make a bad bargain. You are a Rothschild. And the Duke of Wellington has told me that the Rothschilds did a great deal for Europe during the war. Now, what have your Fitzroys done? Nothing. Beyond repeatedly getting leave of absence from duty and showing an unaccountable interest in orchids.
And a remarkable taste in women.
That doesn't show strength of character. Any fool could fall in love with you.
Oh, but not any fool could get your consent.
He hasn't tried
yet. But he will. And when he does, you'll see him. Oh, you darling.
Here's Roth looking positively sharp.
Don't go, Julie.
No, but I must. I'm engaged.
Where are you going, Julie?
I'm going out to the orchid house. Look at the orchids.
Roth, I sent for you because I have tremendous news. This message must go to each of my brothers at once. By what His Grace calls our magic. Great news.
Yes, indeed. Let me have the earliest possible dates on which all private loans can be recalled. Give instructions to grant no more private loans until further notice.
I must know at once the exact extent of our available capital.
The most important deal the House of Rothschild has ever attempted.
So very nice. I'm sure I don't know how they can refuse you anything you ask.
I'm not depending entirely on my profile. Where's my hat?
Oh, the carriage hasn't come yet.
I'll take a hack.
That's what I like to do. It always makes me feel so independent.
Sure you won't let me put a little perfume on your handkerchief?
Quite sure, dear.
You're so calm. Aren't you excited at all about getting this great loan? Who'll be there?
Representatives of all the big banking houses in Europe. Baring will be there, of course.
And the ministers of the countries interested, I suppose.
I suppose so. Leydrans representing Prussia, Metternich from Austria, and the rest of them.
Still, you feel pretty sure, sir, don't you?
Sure of half of it, anyhow. I have private information that ours was the best bid.
The largest loan in history. You know it's the proudest day of your life.
The proudest day of my life happened 30 years ago.
I shan't draw an easy breath.
Don't worry. When I say that no other banking house in Europe can match our bid, I'm not guessing, I know. And now where's my hat?
On your head, I believe. Oh,
where it should be.
Where it shouldn't be in a lady's presence.
I beg your pardon.
To Downing Street and Victory.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Father. Good luck.
Thank you, sir. But, Mr. Rothschild, even your daughter, Miss Julie, pays me more than this, sir.
Miss Julie has a very rich father. I haven't.
Mr. Rothschild.
How do you do?
Very well, sir.
How are you, Rothschild?
Hello. Am I too early or too late?
Early. They're still in the conference room.
Oh, thanks.
My lords and gentlemen.
Your hat.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Barrington.
The meeting is called to order. Gentlemen, bids for a French loan for 450 million francs have been received and recorded. Offers to take all or a part of the issue of bonds, the greatest single issue in the history of European finance, were received from the following banking houses. J. Lafitte and Company, Paris. Gay Muller, Vienna. Hope, London. Bertrand de Lis, Madrid. Baring and Company, London. It is the decision of the conference that the highest authoritative bid is that of Baring and Company, London. They will be awarded three quarters of the issue at 71. There being no further...
But you're mistaken, Mr. Harris, there is.
Mr. Nathan Rothschild.
I'm compelled, my lords and gentlemen, to draw your attention to what must certainly be an oversight.
I regret to say, Mr. Rothschild, the decision must stand.
With my house sending its bid to take the entire issue, and our price was a point better than Mr. Barry's. Why is that not recorded?
Perhaps Count Leydrance would like to explain the situation to Mr. Rothschild.
Your Excellency.
Your bid was received, Mr. Rothschild. But to put it as delicately as possible, it was thrown out, shall we say, on a technicality.
A technicality? What am I to understand by that?
You are at liberty to give my statement any interpretation you choose.
You mean, in brief, I am a Jew?
Likewise, in brief, I do.
Gentlemen, I must accept your decision. But since Count Leydrance has been frank enough to admit the reason for our exclusion, I venture to advise him that these attacks on my race are ignorant and futile. He may strike and strike again. A Jew falls. 1,000 are wounded. But the race lives on. But unfortunately for His Excellency, we are evidently eternal. Mr. Harris, you say the Barings take 3/4 of the loan. May I ask who takes the other 1/4?
That is being taken up by Count Leydrance, Prince Metternich, Count Talleyrand.
I see. A family party. Good day, gentlemen.
Your luck is out, Mr. Rothschild.
The House of Rothschild.
Well, they've been throwing stones at it, and I'm afraid some of the stones went wild and hit you, Julie.
What do you mean?
I've just come from a meeting of men in society, the kind of society to which Fitzroy belongs, and they stoned me because I'm a Jew.
Fitzroy, isn't that so?
Julie, you must give him up.
Give him up? I can't.
I know best.
But you don't love him, I do.
Will he continue to love you?
Father, this isn't like you. You've always fought for what you wanted and got it. Well, perhaps I'm a fighter, too.
This fight's been going on for 2,000 years.
But things are changing. You said so yourself.
I was a fool. I thought we'd swept away these prejudices, but I was a fool.
Fitz knows what he's doing. We've talked this thing all over. We're ready to face the consequences.
While you're young. But what are the years to come?
There's no one else in the world for me but Fitz, and I won't give him up.
Well, Nathan. What is it? They didn't outbid you.
Yes. My bid was thrown out on a technicality.
A technicality?
Because I'm a Jew. But they did me a great service. They showed me just how they were going to behave to Julie if she married into their set. You'll do as I bid you.
Try it, Father. Nathan, what have you said to her? You can't ruin their lives.
No, I'm going to save them. Hannah, she mustn't continue to see this man. You must get her away.
But where?
Take her to Frankfurt and take her at once.
Excuse me, sir. I heard the result of the meeting and came to offer my sympathy.
Oh, well, thanks. If you have any spare sympathy, you might keep a little in reserve for Baring, Leidrance and company.
I don't think they need it, sir.
No, they may later. Do you realize that Leidrance, Metternich, Talleyrand and the rest of the party are taking a fourth of this loan without a penny between them?
But they'll make millions on the rise.
Ah.
He's tired.
Perhaps I'd better call again later.
Ralph, sir. If you could buy government 4% bonds at 60, would you pay 74 for them?
No, sir.
Would you, Hannah?
Goodness me, no.
I thought not.
Nathan. What's in your mind?
Murder. Hannah, I'll tell you exactly what's in my mind. And this may interest you too, Rob. Baring and those others headed by Leidrance have taken this new loan at 71. On the first of the month, they're going to offer it to the public at 74. It pays 4%. But there is already in existence a previous government bond which also pays 4%. Of which we have a large holding. Yeah. This bond is now sitting at 73. Hannah says I'm tired, but I'm not too tired to realize that if the public can buy one government bond for 73, they won't buy a new issue bearing the same interest for 74.
That's true, sir. But Baring and the other bankers will run up the old bonds, and when they rise to about 75...
I know what you're going to say. They make the old ones rise, and then launch the new ones a point lower, and the public rushes in.
Quite so, sir.
But suppose there is no rise.
Hmm?
Suppose somebody pricks the balloon and it doesn't go up. Suppose before they can run it up, somebody else begins to run it down. Suppose for the first of the month, these old bonds now selling at 73 should fall down to 63. Hmm? Then they couldn't possibly launch the new loan at 74 because nobody would buy it.
No.
And Baring and Leidrance and his little band of bankrupt brigands will wait for it to go up. But suppose instead of going up, its tier goes down to 55, to 50, to 45, to 40, why they'll never be able to launch the loan at all. And by God, that's where it's going.
Look at Rothschild. You'd think he was selling apples instead of government bonds.
Bonds are now at 53.
All right. I'll keep on selling till I tell you to stop.
You're creating something like a panic on the exchange, sir.
I know. What kind of a flower is this that Hannah gave me this morning?
I don't know, sir.
Very pretty. It smells nice, too.
Mr. Rothschild, do you know what you're doing to the market? What have you heard?
My dear fellow, I don't hear things. I just imagine them. You know what kind of a flower this is?
No.
52. That means I'm down about 25 million francs. And you're the same, Leidrance.
Can't something be done to stop him, Baring? You're the biggest banker in England. Are we all to be ruined by the gymnastics of a dirty Shylock?
I throw the entire resources of Baring's bank into the pool, but I can't stop it. He's got us on the run.
Right. I bet you half a crown that Baring makes straight for this post within 2 minutes.
I'll take you, sir.
I'm tired of losing money. I'd like to win some.
You're a magician, sir. Here he is.
Mr. Rothschild, I don't have to tell you this is nothing less than slaughter. You know my position. I'm responsible for this new issue at 71. And you're making it impossible for me to put it on the market.
We are both bankers.
You knew I ought to have had a share of this loan. Why did you shut me out?
Certain pressure was brought to bear on me.
Ha! Leydrans.
Well, yes.
Then let Leydrans speak for himself. All right, Mr. Barry. I'll come. I'll follow you. About how much has this thing cost us up to now?
About £5 million.
All right. We'll make 10. I hope I haven't kept you waiting, gentlemen, because I know you must all be very busy.
We sent for you, Rothschild, to make you an offer. You resent being left out of this loan. Mr. Baring, as you know, holds three quarters of it. He is prepared to part with half of that to you. Will that satisfy you?
What about the other quarter?
That, as you know, is held by us.
Oh, yes, you bought it at 71.
Well, we're responsible for it.
You bought it at 71.
It was allotted to us.
And not against your will, I hope.
Certainly not.
So you bought it at 71.
What do you mean, bought it?
Well, you pay for it at 71.
You know perfectly well that no one is prepared to pay in full for an entire issue.
We are prepared to pay anything. Could you have stood a 10-point drop? No. You took it for a rise. You're financially irresponsible, the whole lot of you. Except Mr. Barry. Well, I know just how much money you've got each one of you. And if I like to hold down the market till after the first of the month, and I can, you're all ruined. And dishonored. Including Baring's bank. Now, I'll rescue you on one condition. That you pass me the entire issue at 68.
That's impossible. Now, what excuse can we offer to the public?
Just say it was found necessary.
On what grounds?
Oh, on a technicality.
No.
Very well.
Wait, please. We have to deal with Mr. Rothschild. Under the circumstances, I consider his offer a generous one. And as the head of the House of Baring, I insist on Mr. Rothschild's terms being accepted.
What? Are you going to take it off our hands, Rothschild?
That's uncommon good of you.
Hey, Count Nesselrode. Are you also on the preferred list?
Yes, but I much prefer to be off of it.
Well, we've no choice.
I accept.
I say yes without hesitation.
Don't leave, Vance.
Very well.
To save time, I had this little contract drawn, which I shall ask you gentlemen to sign.
You seem to have been very sure of yourself.
I was. Quite. Will you sign first?
£49.
You won your fight with me, Jew. Remember, victory may be bought too dearly.
Leydrans.
What are you going to do, sir?
I'm going to Frankfurt. I leave within an hour.
Thank you.
even cure a bellyache. Take your pills and get out. You're no good.
Come, come, Mama. You know the doctor's doing everything he can for you.
You must remember, Mrs. Rothschild, you are 88 years old, and I can't make you any younger.
I'm not asking you to make me any younger. I'm asking you to make me older.
She's better. She's insulting people.
There's nothing to matter with her. Just nerves.
Nerves! Do you think I'm afraid of that rabble? I've had 88 years of this, and I'm not dead yet.
But we want you to come away with us for a few months. You're not safe here.
I was born here, and I'll die here. And that won't be soon, either. I'll live a dozen years yet. Nathan, you ought to know enough about bargains to know the Lord isn't going to take me at 88 when he can get me at 100. Well, Nathan, what's brought you here all of a sudden?
He came to see his wife and family.
What have you been doing that girl of yours? She goes mewing about like a cat that's lost her kittens.
She needs a change.
She needs a husband. That's what's the matter with her. What about one of the Goldschmidt boys?
I'm afraid Julie has ideas of her own.
Then leave her alone. She's no fool.
Can you tell me which is the Rothschild house?
Yeah.
That's it.
What's the use of our pretending?
I don't pretend to Father. He knows exactly how I feel. But you see, darling, he's determined too.
But you know we can't give each other up. Sending you away from me only makes matters worse. Did you tell him you'd give me up?
I told him I'd try. I don't seem to be trying very hard, do I? Let me look at you. How long did it take you to get here? How long have you been riding?
I left yesterday morning.
How'd you manage?
I asked Nosey for leave.
Who's Nosey?
That's what we call the Duke behind his back.
Oh.
I think he guessed where I was bound for.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, he said yes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'd no idea your father was here.
No, of course not. What are we going to do?
I'm going to see him and have it out.
Good.
Oh, darling. Won't you see this through with me somehow?
I've got you and I'm going to keep you.
Then will you be very brave? A soldier? And wear this ring.
Oh, yes.
It's one of those family things. My mother wore it.
Oh, it's lovely.
What's the meaning of this?
Father, Fitz has only just arrived. I saw him and brought him in here.
Did your mother know?
No. No, nobody knows but us.
Why are you here? You knew my wishes?
I came here for the same reason you did, sir. I heard there was trouble and Julie was in danger.
Go to your mother.
I'd rather stay and hear what you have to say to Fitz.
Please go, Julie.
It's no use, Father.
I had a good reason for keeping you and my daughter apart. I desire that you respect my wishes.
If Julie weren't agreeable, I wouldn't be here, sir. But her happiness is involved as well as mine.
Unfortunately, we differ as to where her happiness lies.
What has changed your attitude toward me, sir?
Captain Fitzroy, I doubt whether there's a single man in London today who would suspect me of being a sentimental fool, which apparently I have been. But fortunately, I have a certain amount of common sense, which sometimes comes to my rescue. You'll please understand that your attentions to my daughter are objectionable to me.
What is your objection?
You're not of our race.
That's an objection I think you might have raised a great deal earlier,
sir. I was a sentimental fool. Walk through this ghetto. Go into the Jewish quarter of any town in Prussia today, and you'll see men lying dead. Julie's people killed by your people for but one crime, that they were Jews. Now you understand.
I'm sorry, sir, but I still love Julie.
Julie is a Rothschild, and she'll not marry without her father's consent. Good day.
Fitz. Fitz, no matter what happens, no matter even if what Father says is true,
I love you.
Always.
Jews in Prussia know that this uprising is the direct result of your quarrel with Leitrim's, and that has made them bitter against you.
Fools. Nathan has done more for the Jews in England than any man who ever lived.
England isn't Prussia, Mama.
Leitrim's has his agents everywhere. They spread lies and propaganda.
You've got to put the screws on.
Money is the only screws we have. And now, with Napoleon in exile, Leitrim's and the Allies need us no more. It's queer, isn't it? We fight for the peace of Europe, and with peace, we lose our power.
Well, you've got to do something. They burned down the Levy's house last night, and they burned down this one if they dared, but they're afraid of me. You tell all those kings and ministers you feed that if they don't stop this outrage, you'll stop their pocket money.
If I thought Leitrim's would listen, if I thought I could make him call off his dogs, I'd go to him. But
now, don't worry, Nathan, and make yourself sick. The Lord isn't going to desert us. So take a rest. Leave the work to him.
If there was only some way you could handle Leitrim's. For the sake of our Jewish people, I think you should go to him, Nathan.
Grovel at his feet. All right. If you think so, I'll go. He must have his price. And whatever it is, I'll pay it.
I make you gentlemen pay for your wine.
The cards seem to favor you tonight, Your Excellency.
Well, they should. They're my cards.
Ah, Colonel. Any news?
Good news, Your Excellency. Dresden. Entire ghetto reduced to ashes by fire. It is estimated that 5,000 Jewish refugees crossed the border into the Netherlands.
I have dispatched three agents to The Hague to stir up the populace there.
Frankfurt. The citizens stormed the ghetto and fired two houses. A serious pogrom was prevented by the arrival of the civic guard. Who ordered out the civic guard?
The burgomaster, but he won't interfere again. We've explained Your Excellency's campaign.
That's splendid news, Colonel.
I have still better news for Your Excellency.
Yes?
Nathan Rothschild is in Frankfurt. He arrived from London last night.
If he tries to leave, I want him arrested at the border and brought to me here.
Yes, Your Excellency. Upon what grounds?
Make your own grounds.
Yes, Your Excellency.
The House of Rothschild. The house with the red shield. I'll make it red.
That's him, the one in the heavy coat.
Goodbye, sir. And I promise you I won't come back without an agreement from Leitrim's to stop this pope, whatever the cost may be.
May God be with him.
Send word to stop his carriers as he starts to pass through the city gate. Seize him and place him under arrest. Quick.
Mr. Rothschild! Mr. Rothschild!
What is it, Schumann?
This message just arrived at the office, sir. It's from Mr. Nathan.
Me?
Yes, sir.
What is it? Napoleon has escaped from Elba. The French are rallying to his banner by thousands. This means war. Another war.
Now you can go to Leitrim's. Now he needs you. I'm glad to see him.
No, I won't go to Leitrim's. Leitrim's will come here to the ghetto.
Michael, bring my baggage back. I'm not going.
Very well, sir.
Of course, Wellington, I'm Prime Minister, but you're the idol of the people.
My dear fellow, I'm going to retire quietly to the country, surrounded by me dogs and me books and...
Yes?
For His Grace.
Ah. For me, eh? Will you excuse me?
Oh, yes.
That blasted little corset on his back. What?
I gave orders not to be disturbed.
It's important, sir. Word has just reached us. Napoleon has escaped and is in France mobilizing his army.
Mama, dear.
Yes. You're walking just like a young girl.
Well, boys? Come here. Let's have another look at you. You're all growing up, aren't you? Nathan, I think you're getting fat. I'm proud of you. All of you. Your father would have been 92 today. Ours is the richest banking house in Europe. And we're still being kicked.
It looks as though we haven't played our cards very well, doesn't it?
Perhaps we haven't.
I'm not criticizing.
I think we're open to criticism, Mama. And that's what has brought us all together here today.
Oh, is it? I thought you came here to see me. It seems it takes a war and a Jewish pogrom to get us all together nowadays.
Now, that's not fair, Mama. You know
we're almost come. Well, let's waste time and compliments. Have you come for?
James.
Nathan, you run the English house, and so you have the sea between you and trouble. But we, Carl and Solomon and Amschel and I, are here in the furnace.
I know.
And with Napoleon on the map again, our position is intolerable.
Napoleon will be in Paris in a week, with the whole army rallying to his banner and deserting Louis. Napoleon's soldiers must be paid, and if he can't borrow money, he'll take it.
Has he suggested a loan?
Yes. He sent for me as head of the Paris house. I went to see him in Lyon, and he made a definite proposal. Now listen, Nathan, before you give an opinion. We've issued 450 million francs worth of bonds for a government which started packing at the first blast of a bugle. Napoleon guarantees the payment of these bonds down to the last centime, and on future loans he agrees to double the interest offered by his enemies. What have the Allies to offer us?
From the simple standpoint of business, we shouldn't hesitate a day longer. A refusal to support Napoleon means not only the probable loss of a murderous sum, but James's Paris business, my Naples business, will be wiped out like that. And Amschel's and Solomon's are in great danger. It's no longer a question with me. We should support Napoleon.
As far as I can see, the Allies seem to be under the thumb of a tyrant from Austria and a scoundrel from Prussia. Metternich and Lederer.
Mama has said we are still being kicked. And she's right. For a quarter of a century we have stood with the Allies, and apart from what we've got out of it personally, houses, fine clothes, carriages, as Jews, we are just where we started, in the Jew street, waiting for the chains to be put up. I agree with the others. We've got to transfer our support to Napoleon and start over again with him.
Well, son?
You're right, all of you. Every word you've said is true. But still, we must fight Napoleon.
Why?
Well, because we're the Rothschilds. For the time being, anyway, we're something more than five rich Jews looking for the main chance. We know, the world knows, that until Napoleon is gone forever, there can be no peace in Europe for Jew or Gentile. You can't deny it, any of you. We've got to take the risk. We've got to swallow our pride, to stomach our resentment. We've got to go against every normal, selfish impulse in us and do what is right for the world. We can go hand in hand with Napoleon and spread this war over years. We can pay for fire and blood till all Europe is a slaughterhouse. And the Jew would stand as a pawnbroker in lives. We can't do it. We must stand as we've always stood. Not for war, but for peace. And if we all go down, we'll go down with honor. We leave no shame anywhere.
My son, good night.
That is what your father would have said.
You're right. I agree.
The house with the red shield, Your Excellency.
Philistines are upon us.
Who is he?
Metternich, Talleyrand, and Leydrans.
Who could that be, the tax collector?
Something very like it, Mama.
Is Mr. Nathan Rothschild here?
Your Excellency will enter.
Hello. This is a great pleasure. But how did you find your way?
The Duke of Wellington was kind enough to supply us with a guide, Captain Fitzroy, who has, I believe, been here before.
Won't you come in? My brothers and I were speaking of you only this moment.
Prince Metternich?
I won't burden you with introductions, except perhaps to my mother, who was startled by your arrival. She thought you were the tax collector, Count Leydrans.
Welcome to our ghetto.
You will forgive this unexpected visit.
Certainly. We were expecting it.
Then we may assume you know precisely why we are here.
Not the precise amount, but approximately.
May I congratulate you on your brilliant son, Madame Rothschild?
Yes, I'm told I'm the mother of half the loans in Europe.
I am here at the request of the Duke of Wellington and the Allied governments.
In that case, my brothers, too, are interested. Won't you sit down?
We will not intrude very long.
Well, you're chained in at 6.
Speaking for myself, I admit that I come as a penitent. We've not always treated you quite fairly, Nathan. And now, frankly, we need you.
You should join Wellington on the field of battle. He once told me that the test of a great general is to know when to retreat and to have the courage to do it.
The Allies need money. Now, we're not asking you to give anything. You're moneylenders, and you'll get your interest.
You sure of that?
Don't you trust the powers?
No. Austria's bankrupt.
France is already in the hands of Napoleon.
And so is Italy.
Why don't you go to the other bankers? Your own bankers. We have not sufficient capital.
You mean they won't take the chance?
What if Napoleon wins?
I suppose there must be a certain amount of risk in your business. No, we ask security. What security can you offer us? Then don't say you're not asking us to give anything. You're asking us to give a great deal.
I see no reason for prolonging this meeting. As you say, we are moneylenders, not philanthropists. We do it for profit. You may as well know that Napoleon has offered us twice as much as you can promise us, and we've decided to take his offer.
Gone over to the enemy, eh?
I must admit, I'm amazed.
How will Napoleon get the money to pay you?
Steal it. Well, that's not our business.
I always thought you stood for peace.
For 20 years, we've been supporting the peace of Europe. Now we're thinking of the peace of our own people.
The Jew?
Yes. Napoleon will give us our freedom. That's why we are for Napoleon.
Is that your only reason for deserting the Allies?
I resent being cross-questioned by you, Count Leydrans.
I think His Excellency was about to make a proposition.
Oh.
Well, if we gave you all the freedom that Napoleon could give you, would you then be willing to sacrifice the financial advantage of his offer?
Count Leydrans, we are moneylenders.
Come, Nathan, after all these years...
What do you offer?
What do you want?
Brothers? May I speak for you?
Yes,
of course. We require an agreement, a treaty, signed and guaranteed by your governments, giving to our people absolute freedom. In this agreement, they would lose their chains. They would have the right to follow any trade, to own land, to live with respect, and... Remember what our father said, Mama? To walk the world with dignity.
fear we will have to lay that before our respective governments.
You are your respective governments, and you know it. The day this agreement is signed, the resources of the House of the Rothschild will be at your command, and not before.
Very well, we accept.
Pray excuse this, my lords. Some Gentile has evidently strayed into our quarter.
Goodbye, Granny. Goodbye,
goodbye,
my
Anne.
Precious.
Goodbye,
dear.
Who's got my hat?
Oh, here you are, Father.
James.
Father, I'll go on out the carriage with Michael.
All right, my dear. James, it's of vital importance that we should have first-hand news from the field of battle. Somebody to be close to Wellington's troops. Whom can we trust?
In time of war, nobody.
What about you? Will you do it?
Yes, and I'll get word to you every day.
Of every move they make, the instant they make it, and always by the usual method. Mama?
I'll come to the door with you.
Oh.
Let it be a long war, will you?
It shall be just as short as our money can make it. Good luck. Goodbye, Mama.
It's a horse, dear.
This time I'm here by command of the Duke of Wellington, sir.
Give me the ring quickly. Darling.
Well, I must say, I hope the entire war isn't going to be conducted on this romantic basis. Seven fifths right? I give Napoleon 100 days, no longer. If at the end of that time you're still alive, and you seem to be the type of young man that can't be killed, you can come and talk to me in London.
Thank you, sir. I shall count the days.
Nathan, the Times says there's a rumor that the Stock Exchange won't open today.
I wish it were true, but it isn't. Hannah, sit down. When people become rich, very rich, they have grave responsibilities.
I know.
I mean moral responsibilities that come with money that poor people never know.
Yes?
Could you bear to be poor? Really poor? I'm asking you now because tonight may be too late.
Tell me what you mean.
I'm buying on the Stock Exchange when everyone else is selling. I'm risking everything we have to save the credit of England. I'm sticking to the bargain I made. But things look bad for us, Hannah. Very bad.
Are you doing what you feel you should do?
Yes.
Do what you think is right. And if you fail, I'll love you all the more.
And whatever happens, with your love and your flower in my buttonhole, I'll still be the richest man in the world.
Father, Mr. Rolfe's wrong message. May we hear it?
It just came, sir. I thought you should have it before going to the exchange.
Napoleon has thrown entire Grand Army against Wellington.
James. Worse and worse.
Poor Shuling. These are hard times for young lovers.
Father, you said you gave Napoleon 100 days. This is the 100th day. Since he hasn't come back to me.
Remember, I'm a magician. My day may be over, but I know there's a message of love and hope on its way to you.
Am I to continue to buy?
Yes.
But it's sheer suicide, sir.
Buy. Support the market.
But we can't possibly keep it up, sir.
How long?
It's 2 hours to closing time.
Can't hold on for 2 hours.
Then stop this insane buying.
No. I made a deal with Laidress and the rest, and I won't go back on my word. Buy it or we break.
But do you realize, sir, that you're holding more than any man ever held in the history of the stock exchange?
We've picked our horse, we'll back it till it drops.
But here are messages from your brothers begging you to hold back. You're alone in your judgment.
I am blind. Where will Europe be if England is bankrupt? And if I can't hold the market, England's credit is gone.
But no one man can hold a nation's credit single-handed, Mr. Rothschild.
One man can try. I'm fighting in the only way I can fight. With money. I'm giving all I've got to give for the peace of Europe. And whatever other Englishmen do tomorrow, I buy today.
Mr. Rothschild, forgive me, but while rumors reached the exchange that Wellington has been defeated.
It can't be true. I should have heard long ago.
We owe so much to you. Will you do one thing more? Come and show yourself on the exchange. They say you're ruined and dare not face the music. There's a wild panic. Your presence may steady the market.
I'll come.
Too late, Mr. Rothschild.
You backed the wrong horse this time.
Rothschild, you've lost your luck.
Michael. Buy. Buy. Yes, buy.
Have you had any news? What do you think about this rumor?
I don't listen to rumors, Mr. Baring.
You hear what they say? Wellington defeated. You mind telling me what you're going to do?
I have no objection to all London knowing what I'm going to do. I'm buying. Mrs. Rothschild asked me to give you this.
Did she come here to the exchange?
So? Yes.
Such a cold-blooded fish. Puts a flower in his coat as he stands on the scaffold with a rope around his neck.
News just arrived.
Wellington victorious at Waterloo. Napoleon defeated. The war is over. Gentlemen, listen, listen. Bad news. News from Waterloo. Napoleon is beaten.
You've been overbuying. Don't play tricks on us.
It's at Waterloo.
It is true. Wellington has won in Waterloo.
Where? How did you get the news? Yes, how did you get the news?
I carry a pigeon.
by pigeon post from the battlefield. Now you know our secret. Now will you buy? Buy with every security you have. Buy without security. Buy with every hope of your death. Buy, buy.
Tell me how it feels to be the richest man in the world.
One has to be very clever to make a fortune these days.
Yeah, perhaps, but far more clever to keep it.
Really? Well, I wish you'd tell me how to make money on the stock exchange. What's the recipe?
Oh, same as for a cold bath. Quick in and quick out. Excuse me.
Take your hands out of your pockets.
Anna. Strange, isn't it? If young people like that should be just as interested in romance as you and I are.
May I congratulate you, young people?
Thank you, Your Grace.
Nathan! You're worried about something.
Yes, I am. I'm confoundedly worried.
What is it?
Well, Mr. Rothschild, my congratulations.
Harry, George, just the man I wanted to see. I'm very worried. Which knee do I kneel on when I go before His Royal Highness?
Deeply grateful to her adopted son, who by his generosity and courage played so large a part in bringing victory and peace to Europe. His loyalty never wavered, his faith in England never faltered. To England he has brought nothing but honor, and for England we thank you, Baron Nathan Rothschild.
I used the wrong knee.
To trade with dignity. To live with dignity. To walk the world with dignity.
Now let's take a look at the role of the Rothschild family, the family said to be the wealthiest in the world.
Money is the god of our time, and Rothschild is his prophet. Heinrich Heine. The mythology surrounding the Rothschilds' wealth and power is 2 centuries old. The resulting mythology has proved almost as long-lived as the firm of N.M. Rothschild & Sons itself. Ever since the second decade of the 19th century, there has been speculation about the origins and extent of the family's wealth, about their political influence, not only in the 5 countries where there were Rothschild houses, but throughout the world, about their Judaism. The 5 Rothschild houses constitute an early version of what later became known as the multinational. Perhaps the most important point to grasp about this multinational partnership is that for most of the century between 1815 and 1914, it was easily the biggest bank in the world. Strictly in terms of their combined capital, the Rothschilds were in a league of their own until, at the earliest, the 1880s. The 20th century has no equivalent. Because they were so rich, the Rothschilds could plainly claim a material equivalence with the European aristocracy. They relished the sense that they were sans pareil. In this sense, phrases like kings of the Jews, which contemporaries applied to them, contained an important element of truth. That was exactly the way the Rothschilds saw and conducted themselves. There are no fewer than 153 species or subspecies of insect which bear the name Rothschild, as well as 58 birds, 18 mammals, and 14 plants, including a rare slipper orchid, Paphiopedilum rothschildianum, to say nothing of 3 fish, 3 spiders, and 2 reptiles. The family's almost equally recurrent enthusiasm for the pleasures of the table has also bestowed the name on a souffle and a savory, prawns, cognac, and Gruyere on toast. There are towns and numerous streets named after members of the family in Israel, Rothschild-owned vineyards at Mouton and Lafitte whose wines are drunk the world over, numerous Rothschild-built houses from the Vale of Aylesbury to the Riviera, and there is even a Rothschild island in the Antarctic. At the same time, the Rothschilds energetically pursued and acquired decorations, titles, and other honors, securing the ultimate prize, an English peerage, in 1885. The third generation also threw themselves into hunting and horse racing, those quintessentially aristocratic pastimes. They also extended their patronage to include writers, Benjamin Disraeli, Honoré de Balzac, and Heinrich Heine, musicians, notably Frédéric Chopin and Gioachino Rossini, as well as architects and artists. In more ways than one, they were the 19th century's Medicis. From the very earliest days, the Rothschilds appreciated the importance of proximity to politicians, the men who determined not only the extent of budget deficits, but also the domestic and foreign policies which so influenced the financial markets. And politicians soon came to realize the importance of proximity to the Rothschilds, who at times seemed indispensable to the solvency of the states the politicians governed, and who could always be relied upon to provide up-to-the-minute political news. When the former de Rothschild frère director, Georges Pompidou, became prime minister in April 1962 and later president in 1969, Le Canard Enchaîné commented simply, RF equals République Française equals Rothschild frère. Similar echoes can be found in the British press, too. Inferences were sometimes drawn in the 1980s from the fact that a number of conservative politicians had worked for N.M. Rothschild & Sons Limited, either before or after their political careers, at a time when the firm was handling a number of important privatizations. In the 1880s and 1890s, their advice on imperial matters was sought by both the Marquess of Salisbury and the Earl of Rosebery, Gladstone's successor as Liberal Prime Minister. Indeed, Rosebery was married to a Rothschild, Meyer's daughter, Hannah. Rothschild influence extended to royalty as well. It is extraordinary to find that the family's interests in the financial affairs of King George IV predated his accession to the throne by as much as 15 years. How did Meyer Amschel, then the father of an obscure Manchester textile merchant, come to acquire a bill on the Prince Regent? The likeliest answer is that he bought it from the Elector of Hesse Castle, who had made a number of loans to the sons of George III in the 1790s. 10 years later, with Nathan firmly established as a banker in London, the sons of Meyer Amschel turned to these other royal debts with the intention of making Nathan, in Amschel's somewhat old-fashioned phrase, court banker in England. Nor was George IV the only member of the British royal family to whom Nathan lent money in the 1820s. In 1824, for example, he lent £10,000 to the Duke of York, as well as giving him 100 complimentary shares in the Alliance Assurance Company. The Rothschilds also looked ahead to the next generation. In 1816, the only child of the Prince Regent, Princess Charlotte, was betrothed to a minor German prince, Leopold of Saxe-Coburg, the youngest son of Duke Francis Frederick. The brothers at once recognized Leopold's potential importance. Not for nothing did one Rothschild writer of the 1840s point out the similarity between the House of Rothschild and the House of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, those two extended German families which were to rise from obscurity to glory in the course of the 19th century. Indeed, theirs was to be an almost symbiotic relationship. The 3.5 million gulden lent to the Saxe-Coburgs by the Frankfurt House between 1837 and 1842 was only one aspect of the connection. Of greater importance was the support which the Rothschilds gave to those members of the family who left Coburg in search of new thrones elsewhere. Not that the Rothschilds lost interest in the question of the British succession following Princess Charlotte's death. When the Prince Regent's brother, the Duke of Kent, set off for Germany to marry Victoria of Saxe-Coburg, he took with him a letter of credit on the Frankfurt Rothschilds. When the marriage produced a daughter, Victoria, who at once became next in line to the throne, Nathan hastened to offer the proud father financial advice and his exclusive messenger service. Nathan's sons continued to act as the Duchess's banker after the Duke's death, relaying money to her brother, Ferdinand of Saxe-Coburg. These tenuous links were enhanced by careful cultivation of Leopold of Saxe-Coburg, who later became King Leopold I of the Belgians. Nor was his nephew Albert above turning to the Rothschilds for financial assistance after he became Queen Victoria's prince consort. In turn, Victoria and Albert's eldest son was on friendly terms with many members of the family before and after he succeeded his mother as Edward VII. The list of Victorian politicians who were close to the Rothschilds is a long one. Lionel's campaign for admission to the House of Commons in the late 1840s and 1850s enjoyed support from Whigs like Lord John Russell and Peelites like Gladstone, but also protectionist Tories like Disraeli and Lord George Bentinck. They were attracted not only to Disraeli, but also to Lord Randolph Churchill, Joseph Chamberlain, and Arthur Balfour. Even as late as the first decade of the 20th century, the system of partnerships continued to function in such a way that English Rothschilds had a financial stake in the Paris house and French Rothschilds a stake in the London house. The history of the Rothschilds also helps to illuminate the long-running differences between British, French, and German banking, for the obvious reason that the various Rothschild houses worked in similar, though not identical, ways in each country. In addition to the inevitable web of credits and debits with other firms which arose from these activities, the Rothschilds also offered to a select group of customers, usually royal and aristocratic individuals whom they wished to cultivate, a range of personal banking services, ranging from large personal loans, as in the case of the Austrian Chancellor Prince Metternich, to a first-class private postal service, as in the case of Queen Victoria. And the Rothschilds were also major industrial investors, an aspect of their business which has often been underestimated. When the development of railways raised the possibility of transforming Europe's transport system in the 1830s and 1840s, the Rothschilds were among the leading financial backers of lines, beginning in France, Austria, and Germany. Indeed, by the 1860s, James de Rothschild had built up something like a pan-European railway network, extending northwards from France to Belgium, southwards to Spain, and eastwards to Germany, Switzerland, Austria, and Italy. From an early stage, the Rothschilds also had major mining interests, beginning in the 1830s, with their acquisition of the Spanish mercury mines of Almaden, and expanding dramatically in the 1880s and 1890s, when they invested in mines producing gold, copper, diamonds, rubies, and oil. Like their original financial business, this was an authentically global operation extending from South Africa to Burma, from Montana to Baku. Unlike modern multinationals, however, this was always a family firm, with executive decision-making strictly monopolized by the partners, who, until 1960, were exclusively drawn from the ranks of male Rothschilds. There are numerous apocryphal business maxims attributed to the Rothschilds. For example, to hold a third of one's wealth in securities, a third in real estate, and a third in jewels and artworks. To treat the stock exchange like a cold shower, quick in, quick out. Or to leave the last 10% to someone else. The economic history of capitalism is therefore incomplete until some attempt has been made to explain how the Rothschilds became so phenomenally rich. All 19th century states ran budget deficits, and some almost always did. And it was war and the preparation for war which generally precipitated the biggest increases in expenditure. For it was by lending to governments or by speculating in existing government bonds that the Rothschilds made a very large part of their colossal fortune. The answer lies in the way these investments were carried out. Only a few years previously, Meyer Amschel had been arranging payments of some 620,000 gulden from the Elector to Austria to pay for troops and horses in the 1809 campaign against France. Shortly after Meyer Amschel's death, his son Amschel was advancing 255,000 gulden to purchase horses for the French army. He simply backed both sides. Such a strategy has obvious attractions, and it was to become a frequent Rothschild gambit in the decades ahead. Amschel was only half joking when he wrote, urging Solomon, "Do your stuff. Make the Frankfurt House richer by 1,000,000 francs, the Paris House richer by 1,000,000 louis d'or, and the London House richer by 1,000,000 pounds, and you'll be awarded the Order of the Grande Armée." Such transactions probably accounted for the lion's share of the profits the Rothschilds made in this decisive period. In June 1814, Harris listed the payments they had so far made to Prussia, Austria, the French king, and the British army. Including money that had not yet been disbursed, the total was 12.6 million francs, and more was to come. By now, the markets were tending to follow the Rothschild lead. As Karl noted, "When we buy, everybody buys." This reflected the widespread belief that the Rothschilds were acting on behalf of the English government and that this was being done in order to force the rate of the pound sterling up, and that we succeeded very well in doing so.
But now, let's return to Napoleon. Because nothing else in history more aptly demonstrates the ingenuity of the Rothschild family than their control of the British stock market after Waterloo. In 1815, a year after the end of the War of 1812 in America, Napoleon escaped his exile and returned to Paris.
Just as the brothers appeared to be losing the peace, Bonaparte's Hundred Days plunged Europe back into war, restoring the financial conditions in which the Rothschilds had hitherto thrived. This time, not only Russia and Prussia, but the previously aloof Austrians found they had little option but to accept payment from the Rothschilds, as did a gaggle of other states, including Saxony, Baden, Württemberg, Bavaria, Saxe-Weimar, Hesse, Denmark, and Sardinia. Altogether, Harris's account with Nathan in 1815 amounted to £9,789,778. In this, the Rothschilds had invaluable accomplices in the Allied powers themselves, who naturally wished to pocket as much as they could before peace was signed and the subsidies ceased. As their father had taught them, the brothers were always careful to make their terms attractive not only to governments, but also to the individual officials with whom they were negotiating. That Nathan profited from the dramatic events of 1815 is central to Rothschild mythology. By obtaining the first news of Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo, before even the government itself, Nathan was able to make a huge sum of money on the stock exchange.
This is the Waterloo battlefield, about 200 miles northeast of Paris, in what today is Belgium. Here, Napoleon suffered his final defeat, but not before thousands of French and Englishmen gave their lives on a steamy summer day in July of 1815. The outcome was certainly in doubt. In fact, had Napoleon attacked a few hours earlier, he would probably have won the battle. Rothschild stationed a trusted agent, a man named Rothworth, on the north side of the battlefield, closer to the English Channel.
Once the battle had been decided, Rothworth took off for the Channel. He delivered the news to Nathan Rothschild a full 24 hours before Wellington's own courier.
If Wellington had been defeated and Napoleon was loose on the continent again, Britain's financial situation would become grave indeed.
Too late, Mr. Rothschild. Rothschild. You backed the wrong horse this time. Rothschild, you've lost your luck. Look at Rothschild. You'd think he was selling apples instead of government bonds.
Until now at 53. All right. I'll keep on selling right till it'll stop.
You're creating something like a panic on the exchange, sir.
I know.
Other nervous investors saw that Rothschild was selling. It could only mean one thing. Napoleon must have won, Wellington must have lost. The market plummeted. Soon everyone was selling their consols, their British government bonds, and prices dropped sharply. But then Rothschild started secretly buying up the consols through his agents for only a fraction of their worth hours before.
Have you had any news? What do you think about this rumor?
I don't listen to rumors, Mr. Baring.
You hear what they say? Wellington defeated. You mind telling me what you're going to do?
I have no objection to all London knowing what I'm going to do. I'm fine.
What's even more interesting about this story is that some authors claim that the day after the Battle of Waterloo, in a matter of hours, Nathan Rothschild came to dominate not only the bond market, but the Bank of England as well. Whether or not the Rothschild family seized control of the Bank of England, the first privately owned central bank in a major European nation and the wealthiest, one thing is certain. By the mid-1800s, the Rothschilds were the richest family in the world, bar none. They dominated the new government bond markets and branched into other banks and industrial concerns.
Like France and Britain, the Central and East European states emerged from the war with dire financial problems which could be addressed only with the assistance of foreign capital. As Disraeli later put it in his novel, Coningsby, after the exhaustion of a war of 25 years, Europe must require capital to carry on peace. France wanted some, Austria more, Prussia a little, Russia a few million. Moreover, the policy of the Holy Alliance was bound to create additional financial needs from which the Rothschilds could also profit. For the principal aim of the alliance was to avert a recurrence of the revolutionary epidemic which had caused such upheaval in Europe between 1789 and 1815, if necessary by military intervention. That implied further expenditure. The Rothschilds were notoriously the chief ally of the Holy Alliance. To the German writer Ludwig Berner, they were the nation's worst enemies. They have done more than any to undermine the foundations of freedom, and it is unquestionable that most of the peoples of Europe would by this time be in full possession of liberty if such men as Rothschild did not lend the autocrats the support of their capital. Moreover, the Rothschilds were also, as Berner said, lending money to establish Greece as an independent monarchy, which had been another liberal goal of the 1820s. Indeed, they even appeared to be in a position to influence the decision as to which prince would become the new Greek king. It therefore made more sense to argue that the Rothschilds were beginning to supplant, rather than merely shore up, the European monarchies. The first major post-war loan which the brothers succeeded in making was to Prussia, which had ended the Napoleonic period with a debt burden of around 188 million thaler and continued to run large deficits in 1815, 1816, and 1817. The size of the floating debt reached 20 million thaler by the autumn, and the government began to contemplate raising a loan in London. Banking, the third Lord Rothschild once remarked, consists essentially of facilitating the movement of money from point A, where it is, to point B, where it is needed. All banks have histories, though not all have their histories researched and written. Only the Rothschilds, however, have a mythology. world's bankers. The Rothschilds are the wonders of modern banking. We see the descendants of Judah, after a persecution of 2,000 years, peering above kings, rising higher than emperors, and holding a whole continent in the hollow of their hands. The Rothschilds govern a Christian world. Not a cabinet moves without their advice. They stretch their hand with equal ease from Petersburg to Vienna, from Vienna to Paris, from Paris to London, from London to Washington. Baron Rothschild, the head of the house, is the true king of Judah, the prince of the captivity, the Messiah so long looked for by this extraordinary people. He holds the keys of peace or war, blessing or cursing. They are the brokers and counselors of the kings of Europe and of the Republican chiefs of America. What more can they desire? Niles Weekly Register, 1835-36. Whatever its significance for Prussian politics, the 1818 Prussian loan was without question a watershed in the history of the European capital market, as contemporaries came to recognize. Firstly, the loan was not to be in thaler, but in sterling, with the interest payable, half yearly, not in Berlin, but in London. Secondly, there was to be a British-style sinking fund to ensure the amortization of the loan. This deliberate Anglicization of a foreign loan was a new departure for the international capital market. Now it was much easier to invest in foreign funds. The fact that throughout the century all foreign government bonds paid higher yields than British consols meant that people did. The Times did not exaggerate when it later described Nathan as the first introducer of foreign loans into Britain. Moreover, the loan was issued not just in London, but also in Frankfurt, Berlin, Hamburg, Amsterdam, and Vienna. In other words, it represented a major step towards the creation of a completely international bond market. In stipulating these conditions, Nathan not only succeeded in making the Prussian loan attractive to British and continental investors, he also established a model for such international bond issues, which would swiftly become standard. In his book, On the Traffic in State Bonds, 1825, the German legal expert Johann Heinrich Bender identified this as one of the Rothschilds' principal contributions to modern economic development. Any owner of government bonds can collect the interest at his convenience in several different places without any effort. Henceforth, an investor could receive the interest on Austrian Metallic, Neapolitan Rond, or any other Rothschild-issued bonds from any of the Rothschild houses. Although the terms of the loan were heavily criticized in Berlin, not least by the bankers there, Humboldt and Rother were impressed. Rother went further. The Rothschild in this country has an incredible influence upon all financial affairs here in London. It is widely stated, and is indeed close to the truth, that he entirely regulates the rate of exchange in the city. His power as a banker is enormous. In an unpublished passage of The Baths of Lucca, Heine sought to analyze the nature of the Rothschild's power more precisely. Here he acknowledges that in the short term it served to shore up the reactionary regimes. Revolutions are generally triggered off by deficiency of money. By preventing such deficiencies, the Rothschild system may serve to preserve peace in Europe. This system, or rather, Nathan Rothschild, its inventor, is still providing firm foundations for such peace. It does not inhibit one state from making war on another exactly as before, but it does make it difficult for the people to overthrow established authority. Religion is no longer able to guarantee the governments that the people will remain peaceful. The Rothschild system of loans can perform the task much better. It possesses the moral force or power which religion has lost. It can act as a surrogate for religion. Indeed, it is a new religion, and when the old religion finally goes under, it will provide substitutes for its practical blessings. Strangely enough, it is once again the Jews who invented this new religion. As early as 1828, Prince Hubler Muskau referred to Rothschild, without whom no power in Europe today seems able to make war. In a multipolar world in which five powers with distinct interests sought to resolve international crises without resorting to war, The Rothschilds acted not so much to ensure peace as to underwrite it once it had been made. The case was put in a more sophisticated form by the left-leaning liberal J.A. Hobson, author of the classic Imperialism, A Study, 1902. Like many radical writers of the period, Hobson regarded the Boer War as having been engineered by a small group of international financiers, chiefly German in origin and Jewish in race. The Rothschilds, in his view, were central to this group. Does anyone seriously suppose, he asked in Imperialism, that a great war could be undertaken by any European state or any great state loan subscribed if the House of Rothschild and its connections set their face against it? Scherb had made much the same point from a German nationalist perspective in his History. The House of Rothschild has arisen from the quarrels between states, has become great and mighty from wars, and the misfortune of states and peoples has been its fortune. English examples can also be found. In refusing Gladstone's request to make Lionel de Rothschild a peer, Queen Victoria explicitly questioned whether one who owes his great wealth to contracts with foreign governments for loans or to successful speculations on the stock exchange can fairly claim a British peerage. A good illustration is John Reeves's book, The Rothschilds, The Financial Rulers of Nations, which returns a typical verdict. The Rothschilds belong to no one nationality. They are cosmopolitan. They belong to no party. They were ready to grow rich at the expense of friend and foe alike. The central dilemma which confronted the Rothschilds lay here. Because of their wealth, other Jews looked to them for leadership in their pursuit of equal civil and political rights. They themselves had no desire to forsake their palatial town and country residences for barren Palestine.
Lionel's nephew Victor struck a similar note of ambivalence when he addressed a meeting of the Earl Baldwin Fund for Refugees. The slow murder of 600,000 people, he told his audience, is an act which has rarely happened in history. Yet, he went on, in spite of humanitarian feelings, we probably all agree that there is something unsatisfactory in refugees encroaching on the privacy of our country, even for relatively short periods of time. Even in 1946, speaking in the House of Lords, Victor defended the policy of restricting immigration to Palestine. The only logical solution was therefore to find some alternative territory for the Jews to go to. The Nazis themselves thought of Madagascar. At around the same time, the Paris House forwarded to Newport a proposal to purchase 200,000 acres of Brazil's Mato Grosso, and another to settle Jews in Sudan's Upper Nile Valley. Kenya, Northern Rhodesia, and Guyana were also considered. Only at the 11th hour, it seems, did the Rothschilds recognize the need to admit refugees into Britain and France.
This was broadly the argument of the early Zionists like Theodor Herzl, who came to believe that the only solution to the Jewish question was indeed for the Jews to leave Europe and found their own Judenstadt. Herzl made a succession of attempts to win the support of the Rothschilds in the belief that they were about to liquidate their vast capital as a response to anti-Semitic attacks. But his 66-page address to the Rothschild Family Council was never sent, as he concluded from an initial rebuff that they were vulgar, contemptuous, egotistical people. The Rothschilds, he later declared, were a national misfortune for the Jews. He even threatened to liquidate them or to wage a barbaric campaign against them if they opposed him. If a Zionist could use such language in the 1890s, it is perhaps not surprising that the radical anti-Semites who flourished in the defeated states of Central Europe after the First World War did so too. A good example is Dietrich Eckart's address to all working people of 1919. The House of Rothschild owns 40 billion. They only need to administer their wealth to see that it is nicely placed. They do not need to work, at least not what we understand by work. But who provides them and their like with such an enormous amount of money? Who does this? You do it. Nobody but you. That's right. It is your money, hard-earned through care and sorrow. which is drawn as if magnetically into the coffers of these insatiable people. Another early National Socialist who cited the Rothschilds as examples of the Jewish problem he pledged to solve was Adolf Hitler. In an article in the Nazi Furkische Beobachter in May 1921, for example, he named them as one of a group of Jewish capitalists who controlled the socialist press. On at least two occasions in 1922, he gave speeches in which he referred to the significant difference between the achievements of a man like Alfred Krupp, who has bequeathed an immense national achievement through his indefatigable work as an innovator, and the rapacity of a Rothschild who financed wars and revolutions and brought the peoples into interest servitude through loans. The television preacher and Republican politician Pat Robertson's book, The New World Order, published in 1991, states that the Rothschilds were polluted by the occultism of illuminated Freemasonry, and that Paul Warburg, architect of the Federal Reserve System, was a Rothschild agent. From a completely different political milieu, Khalid Mohammed, a former assistant to Louis Farrakhan, the leader of the radical African-American organization Nation of Islam, has repeated the suggestion that the Rothschilds financed Hitler and aided his anti-Semitic policies. A cursory search of the internet reveals a plethora of conspiracy theories. The Rothschilds arranged the murder of President Lincoln, as his post-war policies would have wrecked their commodity speculations. The Rothschilds financed the rise of Hitler as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. The Rothschilds are interwoven with the Catholic Church, and jointly with the traditional mafia and the American CIA, which was pro-Nazi. They are the hidden power which controls other well-known banks, such as Warburg's, Schroeder's, and Lazar's, as well as being behind American financiers such as J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers, Kuhn, Loeb & Company, the Spires, and the Lehmans, not to mention the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve System, an obvious Rothschild front. Through this network of global power, they have been responsible for, among other things, the Boer War, the creation of Israel to control the oil of the Middle East, the Russian Revolution, a coup on Russia by the United States financial arm largely controlled by the Rothschilds, and even the floating of the dollar by President Nixon. Today, they and their associates in the Conservative Party and the press are plotting to monopolize the world's energy supplies, hence their interest in electricity, coal, and gas privatization. It might be thought that a serious banking history should scrupulously avoid reference to this kind of nonsense. Yet it is impossible to appreciate the need for a scholarly history of the subject if one blithely pretends such myths do not exist. In 1823, the 12th, 13th, and 14th cantos of Byron's Don Juan were published in London at a time when their author was embroiled, fatally as it proved, in the Greek struggle for independence. Nevertheless, these late verses indicate a keen awareness of the power of money, and specifically of the new kind of financial power personified by Nathan Rothschild. "Who hold the balance of the world?" asked Byron in the 12th canto. "Who reign o'er Congress, whether royalist or liberal? Who rouse the shirtless patriots of Spain? Who keep the world, both old and new, in pain or pleasure? Who make politics run glibber all? The shade of Bonaparte's noble daring, Jew Rothschild, and his fellow Christian Baring." To Byron, Rothschild and Baring were the true lords of Europe, whose every loan is not a merely speculative hit, but seats a nation or upsets a throne. Republics also get involved a bit. Columbia's stock hath holders not unknown on change, and even thy silver soil, Peru, must get itself discounted by a Jew. That Byron could suggest, even satirically, that Nathan Rothschild held, along with Alexander Baring, the balance of the world, requires some explanation. In April 1825, the market began to slide. The heaviest falls were experienced by British industrial securities and Latin American bonds. Such a severe asset price deflation was bound to bring a banking crisis in its wake. As it was, 73 out of 770 country banks failed. The country came within 48 hours of putting stop to all dealings between man and man except by barter. Much of the time, Nathan was a buyer or borrower of gold and silver. In December 1825, however, it was the other way round. The Rothschilds gave the bank their gold, supplying the old lady of Threadneedle Street with enough specie from the continent to avert a suspension of cash payments. Of course, Nathan would not have made such immense deliveries of gold without asking for a generous commission in return. The operation has to be seen as part of his campaign to establish himself as the dominant force in the London bullion market. The rescue of the bank was a remarkable achievement which owed everything to the international nature of the Rothschilds' operations. In effect, the brothers were establishing that system of international monetary cooperation which would later be performed routinely by central banks and on which the gold standard came to depend. Increasingly, their position in the international bullion market was becoming as dominant as their position in the international bond market. Byron was therefore not far wide of the mark when he suggested in Don Juan that Baring and Rothschild reigned over both royalists and liberals, and that their loans could seat a nation or upset a throne. He erred only in regarding the two bankers as financial equals. In 1815, they had been. By 1825, they were not. If there was a sixth great power in the 1820s, it was no longer Baring's, but Rothschild's. At the same time, by dint of their size, the Rothschilds came to see themselves as bearing a degree of responsibility for the stability of the banking system as a whole. This explains their reluctance to see their rivals fail. In all this, the Rothschilds were increasingly beginning to think in a way fundamentally similar to that characteristic of central bankers. The central banks of England and France continued to be partly private institutions. In terms of their financial resources, they were in fact the only banks comparable with the Rothschilds, though of course they were national where the Rothschilds were international, and the Rothschilds had no interest in resisting their monopolization of note issue. The relationships between the Rothschilds and the European central banks were thus almost always close and symbiotic. Of growing importance as a non-exclusive source of financial information and misinformation in this period was, of course, the press. It might be thought that the proliferation of newspapers in the 19th century tended to erode the advantages which the Rothschilds were able to derive from their private system of communications. On the other hand, the existence of financial pages in newspapers presented new opportunities for influencing the markets, which the Rothschilds were not slow to exploit. Nathan responded to early press attacks by establishing what was to be an enduring relationship with the most influential of all British papers, The Times. The Times correspondent reported from St. Petersburg that the mere appearance of James Rothschild at the Bourse was expected to boost Russian bond prices. By the summer of 1825, therefore, the Rothschilds had succeeded triumphantly in establishing themselves as the leading specialists in European public finance. And not only European. New fiscal needs quickly arose from the political crises which beset the Spanish and Ottoman empires in this period. It was this need which Nathan and his brothers successfully met. The system they developed enabled British investors and other rich capitalists in Western Europe to invest in the debts of those states by purchasing internationally tradable, fixed interest transferable bonds. The significance of this system for 19th century history cannot be overemphasized. For this growing international bond market brought together Europe's true capitalists, that elite of people wealthy enough to be able to tie up money in such assets and shrewd enough to appreciate the advantages of such assets as compared with traditional forms of holding wealth, land, venal office, and so on. Bonds were liquid. They could be bought and sold 5.5 days out of 7 on the major bourses of Europe and traded informally at other times and in other places. And they were capable of accruing large capital gains. If investors bid up the price of a government's stock, that government could feel secure. If they dumped its stock, that government was quite possibly living on borrowed time as well as money. For this reason, bond prices had a significance which historians have too seldom spelt out. They were, it might be said, a kind of daily opinion poll, an expression of confidence in a given regime. Of course, they were an opinion poll based on a highly unrepresentative sample by modern democratic standards. Only the wealthy, the capitalists, got to vote. These capitalists were thus, to a large extent, Europe's political class. Indeed, the kind of people who held government bonds were, very roughly speaking, the people who were represented politically. And their opinions were the opinions that mattered in a stratified, undemocratic society. The singular beauty of the bond market was that virtually every state, including, as the century advanced, all the new nation-states and colonies, had sooner or later to come to it. And most states had sizable amounts of tradable debt in circulation. The varying fortunes of government bonds provide a vital insight into the political history of the period. They are also the key to understanding the extent of the power of a bank like Rothschild's, which for much of the 19th century was the prime market maker for such bonds. What determined the ups and downs of the 19th century bond market? The answer to this question is central to any understanding of the history of the Rothschild Bank. Obviously, economic factors played an important part, but the most important factor was political confidence. The confidence of investors, and especially of big market-making investors like the Rothschilds, in the ability of the bond-issuing states to continue to meet their obligations, that is, to pay the interest on their bonds. There were only really two things which might cause them not to do so. War, which would increase their expenditures and decrease their tax revenues, and internal instability, ranging from a change of ministry to full-blown revolution. It was for indications of either of these possible crises that the markets, and the Rothschilds more than anybody, watched. Three things would give an investor an edge over his rival: closeness to the center of political life, the source of news, the speed with which he could receive news of events in states far and near, and the ability to manipulate the transmission of that news to other investors. This explains why the Rothschilds spent so much time, energy, and money maintaining the best possible relations with the leading political figures of the day. It also explains why they carefully developed a network of salaried agents in other key financial markets, whose job it was not only to trade on their behalf, but also to keep them supplied with the latest financial and political news. The Rothschilds' communications network gave them an important advantage over their competitors. Even after they lost this edge, they continued to exercise an influence over the financial press through which news reached a wider public. Indeed, it can be argued that by modifying the existing system for government borrowing to make bonds more easily tradable, the Rothschilds actually created the international bond market in its modern form. As early as August 1820, the Bremen delegate to the German Confederation's Diet in Frankfurt had a conversation with his Austrian counterpart, Count Buol, which acutely identified the unrivaled extent of the Rothschilds' political influence in Europe. This house has, through its enormous financial transactions and its banking and credit connections, actually achieved the position of a real power. It has to such an extent acquired control of the general money market that it is in a position either to hinder or to promote, as it feels inclined, the movements and operations of potentates and even of the greatest European powers.
In fact, the rest of the 19th century was known as the Age of the Rothschilds.
They financed Cecil Rhodes, making it possible for him to establish a monopoly over the diamond and gold fields of South Africa. In America, they financed the Harrimans and railroads, the Vanderbilts and railroads and the press, and Carnegie in the steel industry, among many others.
By 1850,
James Rothschild, the heir of the French branch of the family, was said to be worth 600 million French francs, 150 million more than all the other bankers in France put together.
He built this mansion called Ferrier, just east of Paris.
Wilhelm I, on seeing it, exclaimed, "Kings couldn't afford this. It could only belong to a Rothschild." Another 19th century French commentator put it this way: "There is but one power in Europe, and that is Rothschild."
By the end of the 19th century, one expert estimated that the Rothschild family controlled half the wealth of the world. Despite this overwhelming wealth, the family has generally cultivated an aura of invisibility. Although the family controls scores of industrial, commercial, mining, and tourist corporations, only a handful bear the Rothschild name.
There's no evidence that their predominant standing in European or world finance has changed.
See, more reaction will be coming. We'll bring it to you here on BBC News. But now on to matters of the economy, not just here but in America. All eyes are on Washington as the amended version of the Bush administration's bank rescue plan is put to another vote in the House of Representatives tomorrow. Financial markets around the world have been waiting on the bill with bated breath this past few days, and these are very testing times for financiers. Joining us is one of the city's most experienced and most respected bankers, Sir Evelyn de Rothschild. He's chairman of the investment company E.L. Rothschild and ran the merchant bank N.M. Rothschild for more than 20 years. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
If this bill doesn't go through even now, what is your thought about the results of that?
I think it's pretty certain it will go through, because the Senate, being the senior house, although perhaps the House of Representatives doesn't like that thought, has put quite a lot of pressure, and I'd be very surprised if it doesn't go through. But obviously, if it doesn't go through, we have an impasse which is very serious. And what does that mean? I think we have to learn.
You've been around and senior position in the city for a very, very long time indeed. Do you think what we're looking at here is not just a failure of sort of technical matters, but a change in the way people do business, in the way that ethics work in the financial world?
Well, I wrote about this some time ago, and I think that it is right. I think what's happened is that the expansion of the financial world is huge. If you look back over 50 years, there was only probably about 50 banks in the world. Today it's not just banks, it's financial instruments. And if you do not regulate them, and you let everyone do what they want to do, then you're bound to get sometimes trouble which ensues, and that is what's happened.
Big city bonuses played their part?
Well, of course, that's the first thing they look at. That is something which I believe that the shareholders should have a much bigger say. I don't think shareholders have been asked before the bonuses have gone out in many cases. I also think the other thing which is very, very serious is a lot of directors, not just of banks, but of financial institutions, didn't understand some of the instruments which were being used for financing. And you saw that in the sub-mortgage scandal in America.
Forgive me, you've got a few grey hairs and so have I. So we remember recessions and problems before. Is it not important that there be experienced people at the top of these institutions? In other words, has there been some failures of leadership?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've seen that in America. You saw that with Lehman Brothers. You saw that with Bear Stearns. You've seen it with the numbers. I mean, I think it's very easy to criticise and jump on people who haven't shown leadership. But I think it's also the system has not kept up with the pace. If I may say, I'm not sure, do you have a BlackBerry under the table?
I don't, but most people do.
But you see that itself. If you remember the number of people today who talk through a machine, a BlackBerry or an internet, and everything has got to be done in such speed, do people really think through what they're doing before they do it? That's one of the big questions. And supervision has not been up to scratch. And if you have regulation, you've got to have supervisors. And supervisors have got to be well paid. They've got to be just as well paid in many ways as the bankers they're supervising.
Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time for this. We're very grateful to you indeed for sharing your thoughts. Sir Evelyn de Rothschild, thank you.
Always nice to see you.
No, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Take care. Thank you. Well, people do get up and leave the studio from time to time. We don't mind that at all.